It's been 2 years since the Taliban regime took over power in Afghanistan. Since then, the regime has faced international condemnation over the human rights situation, including restrictions they have imposed on women's education. Afghanistan is also fighting a humanitarian crisis, with almost half of its population receiving assistance from the World Food Programme last year. Today, Julian Busch, a German journalist who has been working in Afghanistan for a year and a half, paints a picture of the current situation in the country for us. Julian, thank you very much for being on the show today. I'm very excited to have you. You've been in Afghanistan for a long time, so I'm very happy to hear this insight from Afghanistan.
Thank you, Sonia. It's nice to be here.
So before we go into the humanitarian situation, which is right now the most important thing, the most urgent thing, I would like us to clarify a little bit the situation in the country. Right after the Taliban took over power in the country, almost all institutions stopped working. Passports offices were closed. It was bad optics to show how many people really want to leave the country. Banks didn't work. It was very hard to get any larger amounts of money from ATMs. What does it look like right now from an organizational standpoint? How did the Taliban organize the country? What is the structure of the government, the local authorities? If you could please paint this picture for us of those of the government and local authorities.
Yeah, sure. I would say coming from that point in 2021, the situation has improved. Banks and ATMs are working again. There are no restrictions anymore, as most governmental institutions are doing as well. Situation is, in a way, kind of stable. The Taliban are able to control most parts of the country. And beside a few small exemptions, I would say there's a kind of a new stability and security in the country, which is unseen in the last 20 or, if you say, 40 years. And if it comes to the structure of the government, Kabul is still the official center. It's the capital where all the ministers and ministries are, where the main bureaucracy takes place. However, there have always been rumors that the Taliban might move their capital to Kandahar.
Oh, really? I haven't heard that.
I mean, it's rumors, but it's first of all, the Taliban, they're funded close to Kandahar. It's like kind of the birthplace of the whole movement. And even though it's a main center where decisions are taken, it used to be the capital during the first government. And then also the supreme leader is based there. And Kabul is, I would say, just more the visible part of the government. But the decisions are taken in Kandahar. So at the top, there is Supreme Leader Hebatullah Akhundzada, who is named as the commander of the faithful. And he is basically the only decision maker in the country. So there's no parliament. All the legislative, the executive, and the judicial power are exclusively belonging to him. We don't know much about him, actually. He rarely appears in the public. He's usually keeping himself in silence. And as far as we know, he is being surrounded by a small circle of allies, religious adherents from the Taliban leadership. And Akhundzada and his advisors, I would say, are following a really kind of extreme course of religion and Islam. And I mean, it's a mixture of old tribal traditions and then a strict interpretation of the Sharia, which comes from the times of Prophet Muhammad. And with all what we see in the last 2 years, I mean, the restrictions for girls and women, as you know, on education and work, the restoring of punishments such as floggings, for example, or stoning and cutting hands, it's pretty obvious in a way that the Taliban are turning completely back to the first government in the 90s. So they're doing the same things now. And it's kind of the same situation. They're international, pretty much isolated. They are not recognized by anyone. But also, on the same time, I mean, back then in 2021, many experts or analysts might have said that confidently the Taliban would fail quite fast. The country would collapse because the Taliban do consist of like mostly religious leaders, and then the bulk of the rest is it's a huge part of young uneducated soldiers who have been living in the mountains for the last 20 years doing nothing else than war. But what we see today is that the government is it's pretty much effective in a way, which you can consider to be positive or negative. But they have taken some positive steps if it comes to finance. For example, they're publishing a fiscally responsible 3-month budget. And of course, you can ask where they spend the money on, but still it's something which the former governments never had. And they do tax collection. They are able to get revenues from local sources, like custom duties, for example. They, in the last year, they massively increased the coal export to Pakistan, making a lot of money. They're really trying to get investors for mine projects. They started to have road and street construction projects. Somehow, and this is also really interesting, they eradicated kind of the drug trade from Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan is famous for poppy cultivation. And according to recent, there have been some reports from satellite images that it got way less than before. So they do have, in a way, an understanding for, I would say, modern governance, or that at least a pragmatic approach is necessary. And, I mean, as a matter of fact, they are somehow able to keep the country together on a basic level, beside this huge loss of assistance, which was during the Republic amount of something like $8 billion a year, which were going directly to the government. So it's never black and white, I would say. Yeah. And
speaking maybe to the efficiency of the government, they managed recently to get United States to talk to them about the financial situation in the country and the potential return of the assets frozen previously by the United States government. So those talks happened in Qatar. Obviously, nothing was promised yet, but this is the first step into, I don't want to say being recognized, because no country, as you said, recognizes the Taliban regime at the moment, but something is happening in this area.
Exactly. I mean, the big question is how to deal with the Taliban, and you can either completely isolate them and ignore them, but I fear that it's not going to work. So in my opinion, the international community has to find a way to engage with them in the future, because there's no way around them. They are the government of the country at the moment. But then also, like, to all what I said, like, if it's never black and white. I mean, if it comes to the local level, you have a completely different situation sometimes. I mean, of course, you have provincial governors appointed by the supreme leaders who are responsible for the local management. But overall, like, it's really difficult to grasp the situation sometimes from afar, because the governance appears sometimes to be pretty much unpredictable. It's little centralized. So, for example, even after they banned girls from going to school after class 6, still at least until last year, in around 8 or 9 provinces, school still continued to be open. And so there's a huge space for local Taliban actors to decide. And also, it's the situation really differs sometimes. If you go from one village to the next village, it might be completely a different situation. So in one village, maybe girls are going to school, and the next village, maybe they're not going to school. Of course, in general, there's a ban, but it's really difficult to say sometimes what's actually going on. So because, of course, the Taliban, and this is at the moment, I would say, the most interesting point, of course, they have a common agenda or a religious vision in a way. But it's also true that in the last 20 years during the insurgency, they somehow have grown apart from each other, because they were spread over the whole country. And then you have like different fractions in the movement. We have some who are more loyal to the Kandahari roots. You have some who are more loyal to the Haqqani roots, which are somehow Pakistan sponsored. Then you have some who are more Doha affiliated. And what we see is, or what my feeling was in Kabul all the time, that there's a growing gap between Kabul and Kandahar, because the decisions are taken in Kandahar from the top of the government, from the supreme leader and its advisors. But the officials, all the ministers, are all in Kabul. And you do have different ideas about education for girls, or also the relationship with the West. And for example, you have also a lot of critic against the government itself. Like, I mean, for example, entire ministers here, Judine Haqqani said in an interview several times that there's nothing against education for girls and women. The defense minister, Mulla Yaqub, said that Taliban should always listen to the demands of their people. And you hear more and more, it's really small, but if you listen to the nuances, I would say there is a growing criticism of the government. And you might hope, or I think there might be a lot of hope that the whole movement could fall apart each other. And but if this is really going to happen, I don't know. Because at the end of the day, they really try to keep their unity together. And yeah, let's see what's going to happen.
Since you already started picturing the situation of women and girls, let's maybe dive a bit deeper into it. Girls are basically banned from school in general, from middle school up. They cannot go to universities. And there are restrictions about the employment of women as well as, of course, the force to put certain clothing on, head to toe, and so on. Recently, the Taliban regime banned any beauty salons, and we saw some protests on streets, mostly by women. And I have to say, this was one of very few protests I saw recently. Can you tell us a little bit more about the situation of women in the country?
Yeah, well, there's not much freedom left for women, the women and girls in the country. As you said, they're beside elementary school, they are banned from education. They can't go to school. They can't go to university. They are able to work in some jobs still, but it's going less and less. They are not able to go to public spaces anymore, for example, to parks, to fitness centers or gyms. They are not able to, I mean, as you said, beauty salons are closed now, so it's getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And I fear that this is gonna result in the next years in a damage which might be probably unrepairable, because if girls are not going to school for several years, then there's a damage at one point you can't repair so easily.
How about other human rights for men? How does it look like in the country right now? Are women the group that suffers the most when it comes to human rights under the Taliban regime?
Yeah, definitely. I would say women suffer the most. It's one of the biggest points if you consider human rights, I would say. But then, of course, you have also threats and attacks, physical and verbal, against religious minorities like Hazaras, for example, or other Shia Muslims like Sufis. And this year so far has been luckily pretty much quiet. There haven't been really massive attacks so far comparing to last year. But the main threat is for the Shia people, ISIS-K, which is the terrorist group, a subgroup of the Islamic State in Syria. So last year you had a lot of attacks, especially against Hazara people. You saw that, for example, in September in Dasht-e Bachi, there was a suicide attack in an educational center, killing 100 students, especially girls. And then this comes like more from terrorist groups, but also like if it comes to Taliban, you have a growing marginalization of minorities, I would say, in decision-making process. So in provinces who are mostly populated by Hazara people, for example, in Bamiyan or Dainkundi, they removed officials from their positions in the ministries. They're trying to edit the content which is taught in the schools for the people. And I would say this definitely has worsened since August 21. And then, of course, there's no freedom of expression or freedom of speech, and also no freedom for the press.
This was actually supposed to be my next question, actually maybe a combination of two. Are people still protesting? We remember that at the beginning, when the Taliban took over, Western journalists were still reporting on some protests. local journalists. We cooperated with one. It was very difficult for them, but we saw some of those protests. They were brutal when it comes to the government side, how they handled it. But do people still protest? And is it possible for the media, for journalists to report on those, to report on issues that may not be of a likeness of the government right now?
So protests got less and less in the last year because, I mean, as you said, the if it comes to the government side, they act in a really brutal way. It really moved to spaces online where also protests is happening. I mean, for example, like female activists are presenting themselves with written papers and so on towards the cameras or giving speeches online. And as far as I know, this recent protest was the biggest one, or maybe the only one in this year. But it's less and less. The Taliban have arrested a lot of activists. And I was on a protest last year, and Taliban are quite fast. They act very brutal. They come, they surround the protesters, they surround the press. So to your next question, it's really difficult to cover it. I mean, I would say for foreign press, it's almost became impossible. And even though if you go, you might face problems afterwards. Yeah, it really depends. I can only speak for Kabul. I don't know for other cities, but it got less and less. And it's almost impossible to cover.
Would you say that the situation is worse for foreign journalists or for the local journalists?
No, of course, for the local journalists. I mean, local journalists really face dangers to get imprisoned, to get beaten up by Taliban, to get removed from their positions. We foreign journalists, of course, we might face problems, but at the end of the day, we have a foreign passport and can leave the country. So, or we might lose our accreditation paper, but
it's not life threatening.
No, it's not life threatening for sure. I mean, maybe we got beaten up, and also several foreign journalists are getting beaten up sometimes, but, no, it's definitely not life threatening. And it's really worse for the local journalists and local press.
Julian, so let's move to the heavy subject, which is the humanitarian situation in the country. Actually, there are no light subjects when it comes to the situation in Afghanistan. I would like to talk to you deeper about this issue because so many Afghans are fleeing or trying to flee Afghanistan. What did you see? What did you witness when it comes to humanitarian situation in Afghanistan?
In my opinion, the humanitarian situation goes pretty much together with the economical situation of the country. I mean, as you know, after the fall of the old government and the Taliban came to power, the international sanctions got placed, which means freezing all the foreign assets abroad, blocking the international banking transaction transfer. And so then the economy was kind of in a free fall. And also, additionally, what you don't have now anymore is all the international development funds you had in the old government, which made up to two-thirds of the previous budget, which is missing now. So until 2021, you had around like $8 billion a year coming in humanitarian and military aid, mostly provided by the US, flowing directly to the Afghan government. Instead, now you have last year a budget of $3 billion, possibly way less this year, going only to the UN and not going to the government. So as a result, the economy has, it's somehow stable, but it's nearly collapsed. It's running on a really small fire, I would say. Unemployment is really high, the inflation is still high, food prices have risen, there's basically no middle class anymore, and what we see is that more and more people are falling into poverty, and this is an ongoing process where the whole society is like falling down and down, and you have this year, I mean, almost 29 million people out of 40 million Afghans, depending on humanitarian aid. I mean, just to give you the comparison, like in 2020, that number was under 10 million people, so it's almost three times more. The interesting thing is it's not a food crisis. That's what I mean with like it's going together, this economy situation. Because if you drive through the country, the markets and the food bazaars, they are full. But people basically lacking the money to buy food and to provide themselves is a proper nutrition. So you have, of course, rising malnutrition cases. You have more and more poverty and also hunger. But still, it's a situation where you can't talk really about the famine. But I would say I fear at one point you have a damage which you can't repair. And even though at the moment the situation seems somehow stable because the harvest is going on and people generate income, but then if it comes to the winter, I fear the situation could worsen quite a lot, as we have seen already in the first winter of the Taliban and then in the second winter. And that's, for, in my opinion, it's a really slow process, which could end up, if it goes on for years and years, probably in a bigger famine, in maybe in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. However, the most important point at the moment is that now you really see the dramatic consequences of the Taliban policies. You have fewer and fewer donations coming to the country, to NGOs and to the UN. Because it's a dilemma, of course. Nobody wants to send money or aid to a country where human rights are beaten up so fundamentally, in a way.
Sorry for interrupting, but I guess there's also an issue of where is this money really going to, right? Is it going straight to people in need, or how much of it stays actually with local or central government?
Of course, that is a question, but most of the money is going direct. I mean, it's a UN humanitarian budget, so it's not given directly to the government. It's going to NGOs and the UN. So it's a huge part is, for example, given to the WFP, the World Food Program, which keeps the country running somehow. But due to that there's less and less money, I mean, UN had like this humanitarian funding appeal last year. It was the biggest amount in history of $4.6 billion. And then last year they got $3 billion. This year it's they corrected the number down of needs to $3.2 billion, but still $2.5 billion are missing. So it's a lot of money which is not coming anymore. Because also, I mean, in the light of other crises, there are so many other places like Ukraine or the Horn of Africa where governments would rather donate today than to Afghanistan. So WFP, the World Food Program, who is distributing food and cash to the people, had already to cut their budget almost to half of it. I mean, in December last year, they like were reaching out to almost 15 million people. Now it's something like 8 million people a month. So, and this is a problem, and this could, I fear, even worse the whole situation in the country. Because, as I said, like more than half the population is depending on this humanitarian aid.
And you mentioned that there are so many places in the world that definitely need help, need support. But what I see is that Afghanistan is vanishing from this collective view from media. That there are no more reports after Taliban took over the first 2 months. This was hype on reporting from Afghanistan. Now there are some journalists, international journalists, reporting from Afghanistan, including you, but it's not such a big issue anymore. Everybody got used to the fact that Talibans are there and it's not going to change. So the problem probably lies also here, that it's not such an urgent matter in the eyes of the donors.
Yeah, and it's a PR disaster. I mean, how can you explain to your voters that you're spending a lot of money to a country where the Taliban are ruling? And what happened, and it's going to be now a long answer, but it's really important, I think, because what's going on now, the Taliban banned in December women from working for NGOs, and in May working for the United States. And this is a big problem, because for many governments, then a red line was crossed. So the UN said, maybe we're going to leave the country, maybe we're going to stay, but our female employees have to work in the country. So, and this really is like a situation where you have to find a way to deal with it. And the funny thing is, well, it's not funny, but it's like interesting, it's not new. It was the same situation in 2001, exactly the same situation. Taliban banned women from working for humanitarian organizations because, as you know, like organizations like WFP, but also like small organizations, they are not able to do the assessment without women. So if you want to reach to women in the country, you need women to work with you. If this is not possible, it's the you only reach men, you know. It's really a humanitarian dilemma, and less money is coming to the country, and that could be a problem in the future, I fear.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about the consequences of this humanitarian situation in the country right now. We saw how many people were trying to flee the country at the beginning when the Taliban took over power. We saw those terrifying pictures from the airports, how people were trying to hold on to the wings of airplanes to leave the country. We know that many were trying the border with Pakistan, which I believe, but correct me if I'm wrong, was the main path for a while. Do people still try to leave Kabul? If so, what is the main path out of Afghanistan right now to leave, to go to safety? And do you think that this may have an impact on European countries in a sense that more Afghans will try to come to Europe?
So if you want to leave the country in an illegal way, or which is considered to be illegal, then I would say the main route is going to Iran in the south, in Nimruz, where you can cross the border first to Pakistan and then to Iran with smugglers. Until last year, beginning of last year, there was a huge number of people leaving every day, around about like 5,000 people. It's got way less because Taliban signed an agreement with Iran to prevent people from leaving the country. And also there are a lot of deportations of Afghans from Iran back to Afghanistan. So every day people are coming back to Afghanistan. If you want to leave the legal way, the big problem at the moment is, first of all, you need a passport, which is really difficult to get because at the moment, I just talked yesterday to a friend of mine who wants to leave, and the passport department is closed at the moment. Nobody knows why. So if you don't have a passport, you either you try it on an official way or you get it on the black market, and then it costs a lot of money. If you have a passport, then you can apply for visas for Iran and Pakistan. And there also it depends how much money you want to spend. You are able to get the visa. You can get, if you pay a lot of money, you can get it fast. If you pay less, it takes several months to leave, but then you can leave. But then the question is how you're going to proceed from Pakistan or Iran if you don't want to stay there. Because also there's a huge marginalization going on in Pakistan, Iran, on Afghan refugees. So I would say people who are living in a legal way, it got way less compared with 21. Still are people living every day. So the problem is, I think if you have money, you are able to pay a smuggler and you are able to somehow make it to Europe. But then this whole old migration route, which was leading through Iran, Turkey, and then to Greece, it's kind in a way, it's not that open anymore. It's kind of closed. So it's really difficult to get from Iran to Turkey. The Turkish government were building a wall on the border to Iran. And then, as you know, it got kind of impossible to cross from Turkey to Greece. So back to your question, if the number of Afghan refugees is increasing in Europe, yes, for sure. If it's massively, I don't know. I don't think so. I think most of the people are stuck either in neighboring countries or on the way. And also what we see in recent months, or not in recent months, but since last year, is that also Turkey signed an agreement with the Taliban and is deporting Afghan refugees every day. Like, there's the second Afghan airline, Ariane airline, and they're taking people back from Turkey every week, several hundred people. Yeah, it got really, really difficult to leave actually, if you don't have a passport, if you are not considered to be a refugee from European countries. So, I mean, if nobody evacuates you, it's really, really difficult.
Julian, just to wrap it up, I want to ask you, as a person who worked in the country for a year and a half now, how do you see the future of Afghanistan and predominantly of Afghan people? Any ray of light in the situation, something that may improve in the next year, two, five, for the people in the country?
So what I do think, it's never black and white. If you drive through the country, you see also a lot of things which improve. Also because there's no war anymore, and you can call it kind of a negative peace. But then last year I met this guy in the village, and he said, I'm happy because I can bring my wife now to the hospital, which was only 3 kilometers away. But then back in the old government, there were so many checkpoints. And there was so much fighting in this region that it took him several hours to go to the hospital. And even though, because there's peace now, there's an elementary school for girls in his village. So his daughters, which are like 6, are able to go to school now. I mean, just elementary school, and then they're forbidden. But this also improved pretty much in the country. So things improved. But also you have a lot of human rights abuses. It's looking not that good in general, but I can't give you an answer what's going to happen. But what I do believe is that the worst thing what we could do, or what the West or the international community do, is to ignore the country and the needs of the people. And because then I think we're going to be in a situation in a couple of years where either we have a massive exodus of people, or a situation where we could have problems which would reach Europe as well somehow.
I think this is actually a good sentence to finish the podcast with, saying that the worst thing we can do is to ignore the country, as you're saying, because there are real people living there, and whether the Taliban government is something we want to support or not, we have to figure out how to help people who live there. Julian, thank you very much for joining us today. Our guest at Fractured was Julian Busch, a German journalist who works in Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sonia.
Thank you for listening to Fractured. Our podcast is produced by Refocus Media Lab's citizen journalists from Afghanistan, Iran, Ukraine, and many other countries. It is partly financed by Alliance Foundation and Choose Love. However, it is thanks to donations from individual people like you that we can continue our mission of teaching media skills to refugees and asylum seekers and give them a platform to showcase their work. So if you value this podcast and our work, please support us on refocusmedialabs.org/donate.